Hello, everybody, and welcome to Mind Body Green's beauty podcast, Clean Beauty School. I am your host and Mind Body Green's beauty director, Alexandra Engler. On this podcast, we explore beauty through the lens of well-being. And on today's episode, we are talking about the intersection of whole body health and aesthetics and skincare. And I cannot wait to get into it because the guest today is very, very exciting. I have only heard the best things about him. He is a holistic plastic surgeon, Dr. Julius Few. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Alex, for having me. I'm truly excited to be here.
Well, I am so excited to be here, and I am so excited to hear more about your story and how you got into medicine and specifically plastic surgery.
So it's been, as you would imagine, a long but exciting journey. And it started, honestly, when I was 6 years old. And that kind of drive to become a doctor was, I don't even know where exactly it came from, but it was almost like a truly internal or innate feeling. There were no doctors in my family. The only doctors I knew of were doctors on TV. And I became fascinated by one doctor in particular who it was, and this was way before your time, but Quincy MD. This was a show that came on, you know, once a week every night. And this doctor used his medical kind of skills to solve crime. So he was a forensic pathologist. But at that time, I didn't know what that was. I just knew that this guy was really cool and he did neat things. And as this little kid, I ultimately became fascinated because it was Quincy MD. And I said, I want to be an MD. So fast forward, I went down the trail of becoming a medical doctor. I was very much so focused, laser focused, actually. And then I did a rotation, as most medical students and then turn residents do, in plastic surgery. And I immediately fell in love with it. It was the idea of this kind of intersection between artistry and medicine health, and the rest became history.
I love that. And then, you know, you go to open your practice, and your practice has such a specific point of view, and it really does, you know, focus on whole body health. And, you know, you call yourself a holistic plastic surgeon, and I'm curious about how you went down that route and like what about that side of plastic surgery, you know, drew your attention.
So I was really fortunate to be trained by truly legends in plastic surgery. I mean, these were my mentors really literally back in the day, and this goes back now more than 25 years. They wrote the book on surgery and plastic surgery. And so being classically trained, ultimately, the expectation was I would go on to run a plastic surgery department, even be it maybe a dean of a medical school. That, you know, because I was doing a lot of research that kind of went along with that. And what I realized very early on is that classic medicine, and in particular, certainly plastic surgery, it's like any industry, there's kind of a rigid boundary that goes with it. And I fairly early on realized that there were certain things that were considered kind of dogma that I maybe didn't fully buy into or agree with. And especially being a person of color, back then, you have to understand, there really were not a lot of plastic surgery options for people who look like me. And there was a lot of kind of mythology around, you know, there was plastic surgery was really for one group versus another group, especially when we're talking about elective things. But even in the reconstructive space, it was different. I felt like there were two chambers. And so my feeling was, and, you know, and still is, that doesn't make sense and that should not be. I didn't like the idea of segregating of really anything, including medicine. And so really how it started, Alex, was around the idea, for example, and this was probably my most pivotal moment, was right around 2001, maybe late 2000, early 2001. I was a young plastic surgeon, newly board certified. And at that time, Botox was just in its experimental kind of ideation. And the idea of fillers were not even a thing. I mean, it was just an idea for North America. It had been done for a couple of years in Europe, but not given a lot of credit. And so I was at the time, the only person of color that was part of a consensus group to look at these active products. And as part of this, you know, and mainly this was a group of dermatologists, there were maybe four or five plastic surgeons. I was one of them, and young and not exactly sure what exactly my role was, especially because this was non-surgical. But after sitting in and being part of this, which originally I thought I would just go in and learn something interesting, but it wouldn't apply to my practice, I immediately realized, wait a minute, this may have a place, or at least the concept, that could actually expand offerings for very diverse backgrounds, including skin of color. And so at that time, most of my mentors actually took a very negative view. They said, this is not really what a plastic surgeon should be doing. This is not the way forward. And you've had this brilliant training. You're, you know, accomplished in plastic surgery. You should be focused on surgery. And so that was my pivotal moment when I started to really embrace research in really cosmetic medicine, going off into the non-surgical space. And so I ultimately did the first research study looking at fillers and diverse skin types, which was published in the big journal. It's still a reference for the FDA. I mean, it was a landmark paper. And ultimately, I did this while I was on faculty at Northwestern University.
Casual.
And my life was forever changed, because what happened was that was the first time when I had to face my fear of, do I satisfy my mentors who I really look up to, or do I pursue what is really almost a calling? It makes sense. I need to look at this. And that changed my life and made me move down this path of really becoming what I've been called, a more of a holistic plastic surgeon.
What do you think holistic plastic surgeon means? Because I've had a few guests on this podcast who do claim that moniker of holistic, and I'm curious how you approach that.
Yeah, I think holistic, in, as I look at it, and by the way, it wasn't something that I dawned on myself. I was giving a keynote speech at a multi-specialty cosmetic medicine meeting last spring, and that was the term that the organizers and the chair people of that meeting gave me because of the subject I presented. But basically, in my mind, and I'm proud of that moniker, in my mind, really what it represents is the idea of not just looking at a procedure or a treatment for somebody just externally. And so obviously, as a plastic surgeon, it'd be very easy for me to say, oh, you have a wrinkle, so let me do something about it. My view is much more kind of broad spectrum. It's the idea of, okay, well, why do you have the wrinkle? Are you healthy? Do you have a healthy lifestyle? Is there some other mitigating reason that feeds into this that maybe doing just an outward treatment would not necessarily be the best treatment for? Are you at a psychologically balanced place where you're not in the middle of a divorce? You know, there's so many parts to this. And also what became really part of my concept of what I call a four-dimensional beauty, which I've written a lot about recently, is this idea that beauty is not static. It's really a continuum of time. And as I look at this, really, it's the idea that we can enhance a surgical or non-surgical treatment by adding in factors that allows the body to work more beneficially for itself, whether it is giving somebody a glutathione IV drip, which traditionally is used in naturopathy at the time of a recovery process after a surgery, or do we do a series of internally driven but scientifically backed kind of cofactors that can be given orally that then enhance the body's ability to rejuvenate itself. I think these are concepts that are very new in plastic surgery. I think I'm one of a handful of plastic surgeons who are really actively exploring this, but also exploring it in an academic way. So I think I do qualify as holistic, and that's really how the pieces come together.
No, this is absolutely fascinating. And what you said about four-dimensional beauty, I just want to take a pause and zero in on this a little bit, because I want to know more. What exactly do you mean by this?
So I, like I said, I've had a really amazing journey when I started treating some notable people in Hollywood with a thread lifting technique I developed. And basically at that time, I really kind of, in meeting people who I saw on, you know, in magazines or on TV screens or on movie screens, you know, regularly, I was absolutely blown away by the idea that even meeting them in person, they could be even more engaging, more attractive, if I dare use that word. And what I quickly realized is that in person, if somebody does not move, that's a three-dimensional image. So if you're talking to a friend or loved one and you're seeing them, they're right in front of you, that's a three-dimensional image. When you look at them in movement, so if you're talking, like we're talking, if you were talking to me in person, that would be four-dimensional activity. And what I noticed is, and it makes sense for somebody who's an actor, if they're a group of individuals that are totally in tune with how to make their face look good at all times. It's an art. It's a gift. I mean, models do it too. And at a certain level, that's part of their reality. And so what I noticed was they had the unique ability to move their face at most times of interaction to enhance their volume in their face, minimize the appearance of unsightly things. And it was a gift. It was like almost like a supernatural ability in some ways. And so what I realized, and then I've done some study work around this, which I've published, is that if I took a 30-second video of just a non-actor, and then I took like 5 or 10 second segments and then made them into still images, you could get, using a validated scale, meaning for volume in the face, that we have these tools to assess kind of results of treatments. But using a validated scale, you could literally, in the same person within a 30-second window, have a 2 or 3 point swing in what their reading would be. And so what I realized was this is four-dimensional beauty and why it's so important to not over-treat people. Because if you, for example, add a ton of volume to somebody's face, it doesn't move naturally. If it doesn't move naturally, then that interferes with their fourth dimension of activity. And so this became truly an epiphany moment for me. And this was, like I said, back in like 2016, 17, where I really realized, wait a minute, fillers can behave like Botox, because they can impair movement. And the same is true with surgery, certain surgery movements. Like you can do a surgical procedure where in a picture, it looks amazing. But in real life, you meet somebody, and I'm positive you've encountered this, I've encountered it, where you meet somebody who in a picture, on a social media post, they look freaking amazing. And in real life, you're like, oh my God, what happened to this person? And it's because whatever procedure they've had has erased part of their ability to really annotate in a natural way.
I mean, just your last point about, you know, seeing something on Instagram and then seeing the person in real life. When you were talking about this concept of 4D beauty, my head immediately went to that. And because I was like, oh, this concept is not only quite brilliant, but it's even more pertinent today where people do these procedures and, you know, do treatments in order to get a certain look on Instagram without thinking about the broader picture. So I feel like this point of view is it's only becoming more important as our relationship with social media becomes more integrated.
1,000%. You have hit the nail on the head. And as a father of two teenage boys, this is the scary reality. I mean, we see social media driving so many trends and activities, but that's two-dimensional. That's not three, let alone four-dimensional consideration. So, you know, it's kind of a cautionary moment in terms of looking at this whole subject. And like I said, I've just begun to really write about it in a very scientific way.
Yeah. No, it's really fascinating. And what you just said about now is a very cautionary moment, I think is really important to highlight, because I do feel like all of these advancements in plastics and aesthetics are really, really quite exciting. And, you know, I look forward to the future of aesthetics and plastics, but without a sense of pause or without, you know, moving forward with level heads, it could also be quite scary in some ways, you know?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this is a subject that I've been really honing in on quite specifically for the last 5 years. I'm fortunate to lecture all over the world. I was just speaking at a big meeting in Paris. But really the idea of discretion around the technologies. And listen, I've helped develop a lot of these technologies. You know, I literally helped write the handbook for Altherapy, which is a focused ultrasound treatment. I helped get FDA approval for Juvederm. I helped develop its platform, you know, Restylane the same. I mean, so, you know, I have a lot of things that play into this. You know, I've published close to 200 publications. So for me, it's more about the idea that, you know, when you look at everything, we have a saying in plastic surgery, the person who has the least experience is the one who tends to do the most. And so that is the reality as you and I are living now. And I think, you know, it's such an important thing for people to remember that less is more. And I actually, the easiest thing I would give as kind of a memory or flashpoint or talking point for anybody who's thinking about doing something cosmetic is 85%. Do not try to make anything better by alteration than 85% of what you think is ideal. And if you live by that moniker, you will stay out of trouble. The minute you start moving into, I want it perfect. I want this to look perfect. I want to look perfect for my Instagram feed or my picture or whatever, you have moved into danger zone territory. And the problem is you can find somebody to do whatever you want. I mean, it's ever present, and it's easier than ever, really, to find someone to do whatever cosmetically, like as an injection or a treatment that you could ever imagine.
You know, you are somebody who is very clearly very innovative with their work, which, you know, I think our audience can get the sense of just from the conversation up till now. But you also have something that is quite interesting. You have a trademark treatment method called stackable treatments. And I'm curious about what this is.
Yeah. So I came up with the concept of stackable treatments probably now back in, it's 2012-ish, 2011, 2012. And really this was the idea of being able to combine in a synergistic way, non-surgical cosmetic treatments. And so back then, it would be foreign for somebody to think of it now, but back then it was considered heresy, for example, to do a laser treatment and a Botox treatment at the same time, or to do a filler treatment and a laser treatment at the same time. So literally you would have someone have one treatment and then they'd have to come back, you know, 2, 4, 6 weeks later, and then they'd have their next part, and then they'd come back, and then they'd have their next part. And this would be a quite drawn out process. So my kind of research at that time was around how can we safely combine these modalities and get a result that is good, but at the same time, not expose somebody to increased risk. What ended up happening, and I got the idea because I was preparing a presentation, and back then my kids were quite young, And the two boys, they were playing with like stacking blocks. And I realized, I took a picture of it and I said, this concept is stacking. It's the idea of combining kind of a layered approach, meaning you're treating the skin, the tissue under the skin, which is the fat, and then the muscle in three distinct ways at the same time. And this synergy actually really became dramatic. So now, I mean, you can't go anywhere, whether it's a plastic surgeon or dermatologist, without them applying my concept of stacking. And so, I mean, I wrote a textbook about how to do this and the concepts, but basically it really was born out of necessity because I have and have had a kind of a satellite office in New York. And so I would go from Chicago to New York, and it required me to be efficient in those treatments. So that's really where it was born out of, and then the research that went with it.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. And I, you know, I think a lot of beauty fans who are not in the world of aesthetics or plastics, they tend to think of skin aging just within the context of skin. You know, they think about it within the context of dark spots, wrinkles, et cetera, et cetera. But I think broadly, the beauty audience is growing to understand the complexities between skin's interaction with muscles and fat and bone, which obviously you have been, you know, attuned to your entire career. But I think it's an interesting shift in the approach to beauty that's happening now in the broader beauty audience, where people are starting to really understand that dynamic of those multi-layers of facial aging. What's it like seeing everybody kind of like shift into this direction, considering you've kind of mapped out that landscape in a lot of ways?
I feel incredibly grateful. And again, I definitely stand on the shoulders of giants like before me. And really the idea of using principles, right? These are first principles. And that has led my professional career. And so, no, it's the greatest form of flattery is imitation. And so I live for that, and it's exciting. And I, you know, at the end of the day, it's part of the reason why, you know, I kind of have looked so carefully at skin, because skin is, that's the first thing we see, or the first anatomic structure or organ. And I'm, you know, I think it's exciting to be at the forefront.
Well, you know, speaking of skin integrity plays such a huge part in the outcome of your work. So, you know, you just said you have to pay attention to skin health, and that is such like a pillar of your practice. So I do want to ask about skin health as it relates to the patient's skincare and, you know, their lifestyle modifications, and how patients and the broader public should be approaching skin health day to day. I'm sure this is something that you talk to your patients about all the time. What are some of your basics?
I remind my patients, for example, this week I did three facelifts, and all of those patients, really the important, and in many ways the most important anatomic structure is their skin. And ultimately the skin, which is our largest organ, is very dynamic. It'll tell us when we haven't gotten enough sleep. It'll tell us when we're dehydrated. It'll tell us when we're sick. And at the end of the day, being able to do things that basically manifest the best presentation of the skin is critical to any result. I would argue any plastic surgeon who thinks they can just do a good facelift and ignore the skin in terms of helping to aid its appearance, they're fooling themselves. And so for me early on, and especially because I struggled with skin. I mean, I had terrible acne when I was a kid. It was frustrating. There really were no good options. You know, the idea of going to a department store for skincare wasn't even really a concept. And so you went to a drugstore, you had horrible skincare, and I struggled. And so I realized, and it's funny, even back then, I thought about this not too long ago. Back then I said, damn it, I would love to figure out a better way for skincare. as a scientist. So that's part of the reason why I majored in biochemistry as a college student. And so fast forward, becoming a researcher and doing various forms of immunologic research when I was in training and even before training, really what I realized is you can't think about the skin as just a surface, a raw surface that you can beat up and then polish it like you would a car or a table, but rather you have to treat it like a dynamic living entity and think about it that way. So really for me, that led to me developing my own skincare line, originally geared towards my patients because I was frustrated with the offerings that were commercially available. And so to me, I would argue really having good skincare is probably the lowest hanging fruit, the most cost-effective way to allow somebody to look and feel great.
What sort of steps are you implementing within this skincare line? And also, you know, what ingredients are you prioritizing just for our listeners at home to get a broader sense of the priorities?
Yeah. So I think the things that I focus on are heavily botanical based. I am a big fan of history. So there are a number of components that have been, for example, developed in Eastern medicine that are fascinating. And so I've been a student of that. And so many of the products are based on these concepts. For example, green tea polyphenols. It's a concept that really takes its origin in Asia. And so it's this concept of really being able to bring forth kind of concepts that then we can put to clinical study. So I feel that that is what has created kind of a unique kind of approach to skincare that we've come up with, because it's both based in kind of interesting, but not really classically tested concepts. But at the same time, we can apply the same kind of rigor and testing that I would use to test a filler or a Botox, and then look at what works and what doesn't. And so that really has been the cornerstone of the concept. The second part of, I think, what my philosophy has been is it's equally important what's not in it as compared to what's in it. So we've tried and I think have successfully succeeded in staying away from things that behave as pollutants in skincare. And I think a lot of people, for example, don't think about if you buy something that is, you know, not thoughtfully manufactured or is manufactured in a very, very kind of cheap way, that it will come with a lot of different things mixed in with it that may or may not like be nice to your skin. It's kind of like saying, okay, would you go to a county fair and eat a sandwich that you found on the ground, on the dirt? The answer most people would say would be probably not. But why would you do that for your skincare? I think that it conceptually, that's the way to think about it. You don't want to introduce something to your system that is going to aggravate it or make you sick. I think for me, and I learned this lesson, it's funny because I travel so much and sometimes I even get lazy about it and I want to only carry on baggage. So I won't pack all my stuff normally for some of those trips when I'm just doing carry-on because of the size constraints for certain things. And I may cheat and say, oh, I'll just use the wash that they have at the spa at the hotel. And then, you know, damn it, I'll break out. And I will break out and I will, and for me, breaking out is not a good thing because I hyperpigment as well. So it's this idea that really now, no matter what, and that's part of what I formulated, is products that I actually can carry on now. But to me, I think it's really key to have ingredients that will not be viewed by the skin, especially more sensitive skin, as a pollutant.
Well, I even just love how you phrase that, as a pollutant. I sometimes struggle with what terminology to use for this sort of stuff, because, you know, in the beauty industry, especially now, you know, I think people struggle with what to call these less than ideal ingredients, right? Like, I think for a long time, toxic was thrown around. I think dirty gets thrown around a lot. I struggle with how to talk about these things. And I think pollutant is a really, it's just a very apt word for what we're discussing because these are skin pollutants.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, I boil it down to biochemistry terms. I mean, it's the idea of pure versus something that's not pure. I think that, you know, again, our body and our skin in particular, centuries, you know, many centuries of evolution, obviously, that all of a sudden you really, I mean, we're talking about something that has the ability to adapt without question. So it's this fine balance of how are we approaching the management of this very dynamic structure or organ. And to me, it's really the concepts are rooted in just that. How can we facilitate kind of the most important organ so that it actually feels good? And, you know, this is the concept of really what I think should be the mainstay of good, you know, clinically founded skincare that falls under clean. Clean meaning ideally less pollutants. It doesn't necessarily have to mean zero pollutants, but it's a minimal. It's kind of like saying, okay, I'm going to have water. Even if you have bottled water, it does have materials in it that you may or may not want in there. And that doesn't mean that it's going to make you sick. It just means that you're balancing. You're trying to find the least contaminated form of that water.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we live in an environment where we cannot avoid these pollutants entirely. And even if we lived in like a perfectly natural environment, we wouldn't be able to avoid them entirely. And so to your, you know, like you just said, it's not about making sure you're at absolute zero. It's just about lessening the burden on your body so it doesn't have to detoxify, you know, through its actual detoxification pathways as fervently, I suppose.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, so skincare is a critical part of your practice and how you work with your client, your patients. But I'm also curious about the broader lifestyle aspects, because I'm sure you do talk about other elements that go into skin health, whether that be sleep, nutrition. You know, you've already mentioned a few of those factors throughout our conversation. And I'm curious about like, what are the lifestyle pillars that you address?
Yeah, I mean, you touched on a big one. It's sleep. Without question is tremendous. And I certainly see it for myself when I don't get enough. Fortunately, the last few nights I've gotten really nice sleep. So I feel good. And I like kind of, you know, I feel like my skin is showing it. I think that, you know, but at the same time,
I agree, by the way.
Oh, that was not a push for a compliment, but thank you for that.
Yeah, but it's fun to give compliments. I am very abundant with compliments.
Alex, you're very, very, very kind. Well, so, you know, to me, I think, you know, activity. I love now, you know, for me, my normal routine is some form of yoga, even if it's 15 minutes of stretching activity that in current, it just feels good. I think that for me intuitively, you know, for example, I can get away with a little bit of dairy, whether it's cheese or what have you, but a lot of dairy does not feel good. I actually, my body will tell me it's not good and my skin will match that feedback. So I think we now are in a place where we need to, and this kind of goes back to the original point of holistic, is you need to listen to your body. I mean, I listen to my patients who come in. Like I'll have a patient who says, you know what? This happened yesterday. Local anesthesia does not work well for me. So I need a little more than normally you would think I would need based on experience. Guess what? I'm not going to say, oh, you're full of it or you're crazy or whatever. I'm going to listen to them and I'm going to say, you know what? Point taken and noted, and I will move accordingly. So I think it's the idea that we are really our own architects of what is healthy. And I think that's a really critical point. And that's certainly the way that I live. And really that has been the kind of the core essence of what I think is healthy skin. Exercise, good diet, good skincare. Like this morning after my yoga, I took my shower. We have an oil serum, which I love. It's good for my beard, especially because I love wearing black like today. And I don't want all those dandruff flakes from my beard on it. So it's vanity, right? So that part is done. I use a gentle exfoliating cleanser, which is based in fruit acids, but very mild. Again, you could almost eat it, it'd be fine. And at the same time, really then good sun protection, which I do. And I tend to have a little bit of hyperpigment in my inner lower eyelids. So I like to use, I have a product that helps keep that area healthy, which is part of it. But I think the importance is really the whatever product you use is the idea of making sure it's hydrated, you're hydrated internally, and then you're protected from the elements.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that is because people want to make skincare so complicated in a lot of ways. And I think if you just go back to the basics, everything you just said is just like the core of what a solid skincare routine should be. And you don't need to make it any more stressful than that. You know, hydrate and protect yourself.
Honestly, that is, you summarized it beautifully to me. I think skincare, good skincare does not need to be complicated. There should not be 20 steps. You should not have to dedicate an hour a day to this. But there are approaches that are like that. And again, I mean, I've been around long enough. I remember the days of early clinical skincare where the goal was to treat it like basically a liquid laser. So let's burn off the skin and then hope it grows back great and everything else. To me, especially in somebody like myself with, you know, sensitive skin, you can't use that approach. It's you're insulting something that doesn't need to be insulted. So I think really the cornerstone of what is healthy, again, and I love your approach as well. I mean, it has to make sense. I mean, you don't do something that causes horrible distress just to try to, you know, as a daily routine. That's not the goal.
No, certainly not. And, you know, and it, I feel like people do all those steps or they take all those, you know, added treatments and they do it from a place of good. They want to help their skin. They want their skin to look good. But it's just, I don't know, in a lot of ways, I think people have been misdirected and we need to like reel everyone back in a little bit. I'm like, no, let's just get the basics right.
This is it. Keep it simple.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, in-office treatments and procedures for anybody out there who is perhaps curious about going down this path. And I am such a fan of obviously how you approach your work. So I would love your insights on treatments and procedures that you believe are worth it and, you know, that you kind of put your stamp of approval on. So, you know, why don't we talk about it from the perspective of somebody who hasn't gone down this path yet, but, you know, perhaps they're interested in, you know, looking into some treatments for, you know, more mature skin, aging skin. What are some like good starter treatments that you might suggest?
I think this is such a crucial point. As somebody who's now been around and doing this stuff for now almost 25 years, having seen just about everything, I think even for mature skin, it's the focus of basic is better. So doing some form of resurfacing that is a good starter place, like hydrofacial or a chemical peel. These are forms of what we would call non-ablative resurfacing. I think that is a great start. There are lasers that are great that can move a little deeper that also work. I'm a big fan of Halo and Moxie laser. These are the kind of the state of the art in laser resurfacing. They're major clinical testing. It's all made in the U.S. The engineerings are absolutely brilliant. And I've worked with a lot of different lasers. I think that is by far, you know, as a category, it's a category leader. Listen, there are lots and lots of treatments that fall into categories of volume, like fillers, things that are neuromodulators like the Botox or botulinum products, and then skin tighteners, whether it's laser, focused ultrasound. I mentioned Althera earlier. It's a great, great tool. I think in the final analysis, Alex, I think the most important tool is finding a provider who has experience and they're not going to oversell you. I think that is the most important thing. And I now take immense credit and also a sense of responsibility, because myself and others who kind of innovated in this space early on, we did make the process easier. So it's easier for somebody now who's coming out to do this as a beginner to say, oh, I know what I have the map or the manual on how to do these things. And it's simplified. The problem is when you, especially for somebody new or knowing that they're, you can find a med spa on every corner, even more than you could a Starbucks now. And I'm not, even in Chicago, you don't have to be in a big city. You could be in Kansas. You could be wherever, where you're still going to find a med spa on every corner. And the problem is not what works or what doesn't work. It's you have to find the person who's the right provider for it and who has discretion, who's going to say, I want to look at your big picture. And by the way, they have restraint. My biggest advice would be, if somebody says, these are all the things you can do, and they don't give you any warning, or they don't say, yeah, here's the potential disadvantage of it, then maybe you need to go the other way, because it's so important to understand that all of these concepts are just that. They're tools in a toolbox. And ultimately, you need the right mechanic, if you will, or the right artist to say, this is in your best interest, this is not in your best interest, here are the pros and cons, and this is how you approach it. And so, you know, I think this is the one area where you can't treat it like a Starbucks, where you just put your order in and then you go in and hope for the best. I mean, I have an anecdote. I have a patient of mine who moved to California. This was yesterday. And lovely lady who I hadn't seen for almost 6 years. She came back to me. And at first I thought, oh, wow, maybe she moved back to Chicago. And no, she flew in, because she had gone to somebody who she just kind of thought, oh, this is easy. I can do anything anywhere. And she went somewhere and had a version of thread lifting done. And like I said, I get credit for helping really develop that concept. And so she went somewhere and tried to get them to do what I had done for her basically 5 years ago. And it didn't turn out right and had all these problems, all these issues. And so she came back. And ultimately, it was, you know, I felt bad for her, because it wasn't so much, I mean, she didn't know really where to look. And so she made her, you know, decision and went somewhere that was, I think, maybe not as advanced as what she was used to. And then the outcome wasn't what she wanted. So I wouldn't say, and then guess what? She's going to be the kind of person, if she tells this story to her friend's going to say, oh, threads are bad. Thread lifting is bad. Well, maybe not. It's more that she found somebody who didn't have the skill set to deliver what she was looking for.
Yeah. And, you know, that's something that I talk a lot about with my friends, is that, like, you know, Botox, filler, threads, all this stuff, these aren't bad treatments. On the contrary, they can be beautiful treatments. They are just sometimes perhaps used inappropriately. And unfortunately, bad work is very noticeable and good work is not noticeable.
Alex, it is so, so very, very true. My worst nightmare, like tonight there's a formal get together in Chicago. And I'm like dreading it in some ways, because I'm going to have somebody who's likely to come up and say, oh, you know, look, I had X, Y, and Z filler done or whatever, and don't I look great? And I'm going to have to potentially swallow, take a big gulp and say, I'm not sure how to answer this, because it will be very obvious that they had too much filler. So I you're right. I mean, not good work is visible to everybody. And I think that they're, you know, and part of it is our industry. I mean, there's a physician who I'm not going to name, but there's a physician who's very active on a lecture trail, who is a proponent for putting in massive volumes of filler in the face. I mean, massive. And to the level that I wouldn't even dream of, where I it would take me 10 people to get there. And I'm not joking. And so I'm just like, come on, we can do better than this. And so I just think it's such a critically important thing to realize, like you said, just because it's kind of like saying if somebody who doesn't know how to drive hits somebody or runs into another car, oh, cars are bad. Or guess what? That Ford Mustang is a bad car because it ran into somebody. You can't take that approach, I think.
No, absolutely not. Okay, the last thing that I want to chat with you about is how you take care of yourself. I think skincare is an easy place to start. So I know you shared a little bit of your skincare routine, but you know, why don't we just rehash? Like, what's a typical day in the life of your skincare routine?
So my typical day in the life, and again, understanding that I only dedicate about 5 minutes in the morning and 5 minutes at night, is to a gentle lactic acid-based wash that I wash my face with. It helps to, because I kind of have combination oily, dry skin, but it helps to keep me from breaking out, because that's my big concern. Even as an adult, I can still break out if I get away from this approach. And then I've kind of let my skin dry. I then hydrate it. Usually I use a combination of an oil as well as a moisturizing cream. And then if I'm going out of the house at all, then I generally speaking will have some form of sun protection. And then at nighttime, the cleansing routine, I'm careful in the winter time when I'm in Chicago to not over cleanse. So I'll only wash my face at nighttime as my driver if it's in the drier months. And then ultimately, I believe nighttime is the ideal time to use an active approach. So it's either a clean retinol or the youth booster both of these are signature things that I've created, which I absolutely love. And now that I'm getting, I mean, I turned 57 in July. So I don't want to look that age. I want to look my best version. And so that these are tools that have helped me tremendously. I do, full disclosure, I do a little bit of the product I like. It's called Xeomin, which is a form of Botox. I'll do just a little bit here. I can kind of still frown, but not just enough to let my kids know that if they've done something wrong. And at the same time, I can raise my eyebrows. So I think that's my approach. Besides obviously doing yoga, I'll either do it in the morning, I may do it at nighttime before I go to bed as well, and then good sleep.
Well, it's working, so keep on doing it, I guess.
You're so kind for that.
Well, listen, this was amazing. I am so fascinated by so many elements of this conversation, particularly the 4D beauty. I'm so excited to see where you take this concept. I know you said that you started writing about it more. So I'm excited to see how it shifts the beauty culture in the years to come. But, you know, I'm so enthralled by the rest of it as well. So thank you so much for joining me.
Alex, thank you. This was a true pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. For more beauty content from the team at MindBodyGreen, you can always read along with our content at mindbodygreen.com, follow us on social media, and of course, tune into next week's episode. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate and review us. And if you ever want to reach out with questions or insights or thoughts, you can find me on Instagram at Alex_Blair_. Thanks so much for your time.